Welcome to the Utilitarian Podcast. On this episode, I talk with Simon Rosenqvist. Simon recently completed his PhD in philosophy at Uppsala University, and we cover his conclusions in this podcast. We talk about consciousness in humans, animals, and machines. We discuss the best formulation of utilitarianism, and we talk about two problems for utilitarians. The problem of conflicts between the utilitarian judgments and our moral intuitions, and the problem of action guidance, which is roughly the problem that utilitarianism is not useful when deciding what we should do, since what we should do depends on the consequences of our actions millions of years into the future. Hi, Simon. Welcome to the Utilitarian Podcast.
Hi, great to be here.
You have recently finished your PhD. It's called Hedonistic Act Utilitarianism, Action Guidance, and Moral Intuitions.
Yes, so that's right.
That's what we're going to talk about here. In the beginning of the thesis, you formulate Hedonistic Act Utilitarianism. So just in a basic sense, could you tell us what this is?
Right. So, I mean, it's very simple, probably one of the most simple moral theories. And the idea is simply that an act is right then, or permissible, if it produces at least as much pleasure minus pain as any alternative act available to the agent. And the act is wrong if it does not do so. So it's what the slogan here is: maximize pleasure minus pain. And that's what we should do. So that's the very simple summary then of this theory.
You quickly mention why you choose hedonistic utilitarianism over attitudinal utilitarianism. Could you tell us about the problem with attitudinal utilitarianism?
Right. So the attitudinal view here, so that's a kind of hedonistic utilitarianism, of course, but it focuses on attitudinal pleasures and pain instead of sensory pleasures and pain then. So what are attitudinal pleasure and pain? Well, basically, it's about taking pleasure in something or taking pain in something. So it's about attitudes, pleasure or pain attitudes. So for example, I might say, I really enjoyed working out today, and that's taking pleasure in working out. And so, yeah, so, I mean, there are a number of problems with this view. I mean, one issue is that it seems that, well, take this case for example. It seems that I can take pleasure in something without actually having any pleasurable sensations then, and so that's completely possible then on this view. And then it seems that, do we really count what matters in this case then if I don't feel any nice, good feeling sensations? Well, I would say no. And then there's also this problem that a lot of animals, for example, animals with lower cognitive capacities, for example, perhaps snails, also they are probably like a borderline case, may be able to feel these kind of nice sensations, but may not be able to take up these attitudes then. And I think that, well, if these animals then are sentient then, and they have these kind of pleasure and pain sensations, I think they should count, even if they cannot take any attitudinal pleasure. So that's what I think. And some people might disagree and say that, well, that's another reason why we should exclude snails and why I may kill them in my garden. But yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It does probably come down to the attitudinal theory being, in a sense, disproven is too strong of a word, but it is weakened by considerations of what we could call lower animals, like snails, you mentioned.
Yeah.
So just out of curiosity, what is, do you believe snails are conscious?
I don't know. I mean, so from what I understand, they have a very primitive cognitive structure, and much more primitive than arthropods, for example. But yeah, I have no idea. I mean, apparently they react to light, I think. I'm not sure if they also react to humidity. I would guess so. I mean, that would
I know
give
that they
me some reason, at least, to think that they...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Ahead. And a touch as well, right? So, I mean, just that you have these different sensory modalities, that would at least suggest to me that, well, weakly suggest that they have some kind of phenomenal consciousness. But yeah, who knows?
I think that the history of considerations of consciousness or philosophy of consciousness, just it shows a kind of a broadening of the set of creatures we consider conscious. At some point, I believe that newborn babies weren't considered conscious, and animals certainly were seen as non-conscious creatures. I think the line now is at insects or snails or something like that.
Yeah, but it's also difficult, right? Because it might be that, so we have this kind of, on the other hand, on the one side, we have this instinct to restrict consciousness then to the kind of our closest sphere of human, perhaps even adult humans sometime. But then there is also this opposite instinct that when something behaves in a way which we identify, which we like to ascribe it consciousness. So it might, who knows? It might also be the case that we will see a kind of opposite movement at some point. But I definitely, yeah, as you say, from what I've heard and read, it seems like the consciousness threshold has definitely moved downwards in the scale of animals then.
This might become a huge question in the future if we begin to have more lifelike robots or AIs.
Right.
Then it might move in the opposite directions if there's an unwillingness to consider computers conscious or consider functional equivalents of humans to be conscious.
Right. I mean, this is beyond my small area of expertise, but I'm kind of feel a bit fearful that we will actually go wrong in the opposite direction. I mean, so a lot of people in these AI literature seem to think that it's very natural then or it's very obvious that there's no principal problem with artificial intelligences than having consciousness. But I mean, I think the problem is that, I mean, I don't see why that would be so, but I also think it's a bit scary that even if they didn't have it, we would probably ascribe it as soon as they start to have the right kind of functional, to be able to converse fluently with us and so on. So I kind of fear, just like I'm comfortable with people not ascribing animals consciousness, lower animals consciousness. I also feel a bit uncomfortable with the idea that people would just give a lot of non-sentient entities. We just happen to be intelligent and consciousness. So, but that's kind of a utilitarian worry. I mean, I haven't read that much of the like this consciousness literature, so I don't know whether this worry is well-founded.
There's danger on both sides. I could see us. It would be an enormous ethical mistake to say hand over civilization to a group of AIs or robots or who then turn out to not be conscious. From my perspective, no matter what complex structures they create and interactions they have and so on, it would be the equivalent of just rocks bumping into each other if they aren't conscious.
And imagine that you would have this future when people think that they are uploading then in some sense their consciousness, and the result then are actually intelligent, this could be some kind of software then or a brain emulation which actually behaves just like these people and so on. So people keep doing this. And at the end, what you have is basically a planet populated by a lot of intelligent, non-sentient beings. that would be not an existential risk, but a moral catastrophe of some kind. But
I agree. Also in virtue of how easy it is for us to ascribe consciousness to non-conscious, or what we are pretty sure what we consider non-conscious things. So an example here would be some time ago, I threw out an old school alarm clock. And when it hit into the bag of trash, it made a sound that registered in my mind as a kind of sad sound. I immediately felt bad for the alarm clock.
Yeah.
Even though I am almost certain. I mean, that it is unconscious. It is plastic and metal. So.
And you can't escape that feeling, right? So even now that you know that, if you try to think of this alarm clock lying there in the trash, I mean, being demolished and by some giant trash machine crusher, then, I mean, you still get that little feeling, right? It seems that these kind of... it's almost unavoidable. It's very non-rational, this kind of ascribing this kind of consciousness, but also feeling emotional then about these things.
It is. It does seem to be a quick intuition that just arises non-voluntarily. And it had an impact on my behavior. I did pull out the alarm clock from the trash and saved it so as to not hurt the alarm clock, even though I was completely aware of how nonsensical this action was.
Yeah, I mean, it might be sensical since it might be painful to not do that then. So,
oh yeah,
I see. It's irrational in some sense, definitely. Yeah, I have this. Yeah, it's really difficult. I think that this shows why it's so important with philosophy and also philosophy of mind. I mean, we have to solve or at least approximate some solution to a lot of these philosophical issues before we get into this kind of, before we have too much technological capacity to do a lot of stuff. Then, so, I mean, before brain emulations, for example, become feasible, whenever that is, I mean, in 100 years, say. But before that, we have to have solved a lot of the philosophical issues here, because otherwise we risk doing a lot of really weird or bad stuff. So,
I share that worry. What do you say to the person who consider these problems to be pseudo problems and just declares that if some humanoid robot is functionally equivalent, or if a brain emulation is functionally equivalent to a human, then we should grant it the same moral status. That there is no deep problem of consciousness.
Yeah, I know. I haven't never really understood that position. I mean, so one idea is simply that there is no such thing as phenomenal consciousness, as what we refer to. Usually refer to it. So, I mean, phenomenal consciousness doesn't exist, then that's a perfectly fine possibility. I mean, you could try to argue for that. I mean, I at least know one such phenomenal consciousness, so I think I'm pretty sure that there's at least one of them, and probably more than me then. But if you think that there are phenomenal consciousness, then surely that is what matters morally. And in that case, I don't see why it would matter that these have the kind of same behavioral aspect than people and robots, for example, or people and intelligences of various kinds. I mean, if they lack the phenomenal part, surely that's the important moral thing here. I mean, the phenomenal issue. I mean, and I think that this becomes so clear when we consider our own lives, how much we care about anxiety, sadness, and these kind of pleasant moments, calm, and all these kind of happiness feelings, and so on. So I just think that, I mean, if there is phenomenal consciousness, at least, then it's just obvious that is really important and very central for more. Perhaps not all of that moral important, but at least a central part. And then I don't see how this can be a pseudo problem. So, but yeah, I might not understand that position. There's a lot of things I don't understand in philosophy of mind in general, I should say. So, and this kind of like physical or theories and the idea of functional equivalence here and how this and also this I've never really understood this idea of this kind of multiple draw theory then of the mind and so on. I just think that I don't know enough about it to really to have something to think that clearly. I do think that from a very commonsensical, non-philosophical point of view, it's obvious that we have phenomenal consciousness and that it matters a lot. And so.
So one starting point for many utilitarians is to say that consciousness is a necessary condition for moral status, or it's the basis of what we care about morally. Do you think we should abandon this as a necessary condition if we came to believe that there is no such thing as phenomenal consciousness? Or should we just say then that, well, the necessary condition is never satisfied, so we accept some form of nihilism instead?
Right. So, yeah, I would probably say that then, I mean, if there is no phenomenal consciousness in the world, I should say that we should try to create it. And if it's not even possible in a metaphysical, I mean, it's not even metaphysical possible to create that, it really doesn't matter what we do. That's my view. I mean, I do think that the issue of moral status is a bit weird when looking at it from a utilitarian perspective. And I mean, so for example, a person in coma doesn't have consciousness, then we can assume that it's a very deep coma. And I still think that there's a lot of reasons for utilitarians to safeguard this person's life and try to make this person come awake then. Similarly, a person who would be deep frozen then in some future, so you have these kind of cryogenics people. I mean, I think that there's a lot of reason for utilitarians to try to awaken them, but they don't have consciousness either, right? Because they're probably dead in any reasonable definition of death. So I'm not sure that moral status is that should be that important for utilitarians. I mean, they should be looking at the kind of pleasure and pain which can be realized. And that might include ignoring or not giving any consideration to sentient conscious creatures. And it might also involve then like the cryogenics case then giving a lot of consideration to non-conscious entities.
But isn't this all cashed out in a sense in terms of conscious experiences in the end? If we're interested in creating consciousness or awakening cryogenically frozen people, so in the end it cashes out in terms of consciousness.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I just think that so there's a lot of talk about moral status. I think that has been an important way of marketing like the animal rights movement, which I identify with a lot. But I also think that it's kind of a sidetrack if you're a utilitarian, because what matters is pleasure and pain. What matters isn't in some way. I mean, moral status is kind of an issue besides the point, just like rights and equality and so on. I mean, so, yeah. But I mean, it might still be a pragmatic, it might be a good thing. For example, it might be a good thing to have this kind of termed and moral status just to help people see what kind of creatures they should think about when acting. And that might, of course, promote pleasure and pain.
I just meant by moral status, I meant to tie it to conscious experiences quite tightly in a sense. So the only moral patients are conscious beings.
All right. Yeah, sure. I mean, that seems fine.
Let's get back to this formulation that you introduced your dissertation with. I sent to you an alternative that I would like to discuss, and it is this. I wrote, the goodness of X is proportional to the pleasure caused by X, and the badness of X is proportional to the pain caused by X. So before you react, let me just say why I find this in a sense more general than the formulation, the kind of classically philosophical formulation of hedonistic act utilitarianism.
Sure.
If we think of goodness being proportional to pleasure, then we can put anything in the place of X and see that we can evaluate institutions, we can evaluate AIs, countries, people, groups of people, and we are not left with. So the classical formulation is very strict in that it is only permissible to maximize the balance of pleasure over pain. Here we can say that some act is good to such and such degree, and I think that's valuable because which we will talk about later. It is so incredibly difficult to actually maximize utility.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, I agree. I think that this sounds like a plausible view. I guess that you talk here about instrumental goodness or badness, right? Because if you don't, then a nice book could be like intrinsically good then, and you didn't, because it might cause pleasure then, right? So,
well, I didn't differentiate between intrinsic and instrumental value, and maybe I should have.
No, I mean, it's fine. I mean, it's important to not commit to anything which can be held against you, right? So, since I'm agreeing now, I definitely think this sounds like a good idea, and as long as it's in terms of instrumental goodness, then. So it's, and I also liked what you said just after about this kind of. That you can evaluate a lot of things then. So this is the kind of global consequentialism, global utilitarian idea that you can evaluate a lot of things then in terms of the consequence and not just the acts, for example. And I think that's a kind of sensible extension then of the traditional consequentialist or utilitarian theory then. So I like all that. Also about what you said in the end then about this, so the idea that there's this degree then of goodness and badness of acts then. And I guess it's also, I mean, you might also accept degrees of rightness and wrongness, right? So a lot of people do that as well.
Yeah.
That seems fine to me as well. I mean, I don't think that excludes saying that there are also, an act can also be right and wrong. Just like, I mean, a lot of kind of, for example, something can be reliable to various degrees, but it can also be reliable or unreliable. So I just think that we should say the same thing then about rightness and wrongness.
Do you find rightness or goodness to be the most fundamental? Because in my view, rightness is one of many derived notions, and rightness is in a sense derived from goodness. Do you agree?
I would definitely say that goodness is more fundamental than rightness. Then I'm not sure if I would say that goodness is the most fundamental. I think that, I mean, pleasure and pain to me is much more fundamental than either of these kind of moral or evaluative concepts. Then,
go ahead.
No, so for example, if you manage to convince me then that, for example, that an act. For example, that pain would be good and pleasure would be bad, then I would say that we should maximize badness minus goodness. Then, so I think that pleasure and pain is the kind of, to me, that's the kind of most fundamental starting point. And then if someone managed to argue then that goodness is in fact that pain is in fact good, then I would say that, well, let's do the bad. Let's get more badness in the world. I mean, more pleasure then.
Well, it might just be a semantic point because I think we agree, but I would say that goodness just is pleasure and badness just is pain. And so in a sense, goodness and pain are both goodness and pleasure are both descriptions of the same fundamentally evaluative notion.
Right. Yeah, it might be. It might be that we agree here. It's always so difficult when you start talking about identity, right? So, I mean, I don't think that there is... I mean, I don't think that what we have here is... I think that there are different concepts. So it's not... On a semantic level, they're definitely different. So it's not... It's is pleasure good? Is an open question, for example. It's not like saying, is something good, good? But then it might be, of course, that it's identical in some other sense, in the sense that by metaphysical necessity or something, whenever you something is pleasant, it's also good. That sounds perhaps more plausible.
Yeah, I think with regards to Moore's open question, it's I've always kind of is this what I want to avoid is to argue about definitions of words or how words are used among people and so on. So what I would say is that we have a shared concept of badness and that this concept arises from our experiences of pain.
Right. And I mean, that's actually compatible with badness and pain that badness doesn't have the same meaning as pain, right? So it's not that bad means painful, for example, right? So it's much just that badness, that's a kind of, there's this kind of historical connection then between them. So let me just say something briefly why I'm a bit hesitant here, because I think a lot of utilitarians would just immediately jump on the same bandwagon as you here. But I mean, so I think it's really important that we have this kind of, this explanatory project, I think it's really important. So we are trying to explain why acts are right or wrong. We are trying to explain why certain things are good or bad. And I think that if there is this kind of very close identity, then pleasure and pain cannot be part of the explanation here, because something cannot... So, I mean, that something is pleasant cannot be explained by it being pleasant, for example. So I think that they are different things than goodness and pleasantness are different things than, and one explains the other then. So that something is good is explained by its being pleasant, or its being having a positive pleasure minus painness. I mean, there are different ways of going there, but.
Well, again, it's as if we are very close to being in agreement here, but
it might not matter that much, I guess. I mean, it depends on, it depends on kind of also what, I guess, what kind of trajectory you're coming from. I mean, if you have this kind of, so I'm very interested in theoretical stuff connected to ethics then, and then these kind of explanatory issues and so on, they become pretty important. But if you don't think that important, it might not make that much of a difference, I guess, what you say here. It's also important to me that, for example, Kantians and utilitarians don't just have a semantic, I mean, they are not just having a it's not
disagreeing
just
disagreeing over the
issue.
Meaning of words, or
yeah, right. So,
well, yeah, okay. So one point is that I agree that it is the pleasantness that explains why pleasure is good. Let's say,
yeah.
So in that sense, pleasantness is fundamental. Let's say, one thing we should touch upon is this pleasure minus pain, because that is also something you discuss in your dissertation. It, when reading your dissertation, for the first time, it occurred to me how weird this phrase is. How can we detract some pain from pleasure and then it reaches a lower level of pleasure? How do we make sense of this phrase?
Yeah, it's really weird. It's almost as weird as this kind of the greatest pleasure for the greatest number or whatever it is. I mean, that's completely nonsensical, I think, but this is a bit close to it, I think. But yeah,
you mean Bentham's original formulation? Yeah. Well, that I guess that just fails because a creature could because of utility monsters, basically, if they exist, then the greatest pleasure wouldn't be for the greatest number.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's also it's just weird. But let's go. Let's return to this. What you talked about. Pleasure minus pain. Yeah. So should I say what my view on this here is?
Definitely.
So I think that pleasures and pains, I mean, they can be understood in two ways. They can be understood attitudinally, so they are attitudinal pleasure and pains, and then they can be understood as sensory pleasures and pains. And well, sensory pleasures and pains, they are basically sensations then. So it's when I drink a cup of coffee, I have nice sensations from the dopamine rush and perhaps from the reduced tiredness and so on. And it's really weird to use this pleasures and pains, to use the sense to refer to the sensations, I think, in this formulation. And I mean, one problem, as you mentioned, is this kind of, how do we even make sense of this kind of mathematical subtraction here? But I mean, another problem is that there are a lot of sensations which are not pleasures, but I think hedonists should count. So for example, feeling calm, I think that should count. That's a positive in some sense, a positive sensation, but it need not be a pleasure. I mean when I feel calm, if someone asks me, do you have a very strong pleasure right now? I would say, no, I don't have any pleasure right now. I'm just feeling very relaxed. No pleasures, no pains, you know, just kind of this meditative state. And then there are a lot of negative sensations, which I do not think qualify properly as pains, at least not as we usually use the word. And for example, anxiety, sadness, and you also have this kind of restlessness, And which might approach painfulness, but I think isn't really in most cases correctly described as a pain. So that's why I suggested then a bit briefly then in the dissertation that we should instead move to the more fundamental issue then of pleasantness and unpleasantness then. So we should look to all sensations and we should look to the degrees of pleasantness and unpleasantness of these sensations. When you have this sensation of being calm and being very relaxed, that's a somewhat at least pleasant sensations, even if it doesn't count as a pleasure. And anxiety then is an unpleasant sensation, even if it isn't a pain then. And even if it isn't painful then. So I think the pain should be unpleasantness is a much better term than painfulness. Yeah, so that's the idea, basically, that the most basic hedonic... So what you have is basically three hedonic dimensions, right? So you have the attitudinal dimension, you have the kind of paradigmatic pleasure and pain sensations, and then you have this kind of property which sensations can have, namely... pleasantness and painful unpleasantness then. And it's the third dimension, I think, that hedonistic utilitarians should work with. So this is this is a bit similar to the discussions about hedonic tone views about pleasure and pain then. But the difference here is that what I'm suggesting is not that we define pleasures and pains in terms of hedonic tone in some way, but that we move from focusing on pleasures and pains to focusing on these kind of pleasantness and pain or unpleasantness. Yeah.
And so feeling calm and feeling happy, feeling tranquil and so on, they share this property of pleasantness.
Yeah, right. That's the idea. Right.
And that's a broad notion. So you have in a sense broadened the notions and to include everything we would want to include.
I'm not sure. I think so. I mean, there's these always these kind of two movements in philosophy. You have some people who really like, I mean, going to a technical terminology very quickly. And I'm really in the camp of just trying to keep the common sense non-technical notions. And this, I'm not trying to extend the notion of pleasantness or unpleasantness here. I mean, I just think that just in the basic, ordinary, non-philosophical sense. But of course, it is broader in the sense that there are a lot of sensations which are pleasant, even if they are not pleasures then. So in that sense, it's broader. Just like there are a lot of things that are salty without being salts then. So that's a kind of bit weird comparison, perhaps.
Well, I can understand this move, and I can also understand the desire to keep the common sense notion, because otherwise it so quickly diverges from what we seem to be talking about in normal everyday life.
Right.
Do you worry that pleasantness and unpleasantness exclude some very exotic states that we might want to mental states that we might want to include as hedonic utilitarians? And here I'm thinking about mental states that arise from deep meditation or psychedelics and so on, which might not have this property of pleasantness, but which we could still want to include, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a legitimate worry. I mean, I'm not worried, but perhaps I should be. But I mean, that's just the nature of the game, I think. There's a lot of things which I worry that we might exclude. For example, take this. So here on Earth, then, what we have is that we have evolved this kind of phenomenal consciousness, then. Well, this would be my view, at least. Philosophers of mind might perhaps disagree here. But I mean, we have this kind of phenomenal consciousness, and then we have... Then we have seen that it has moral value, great, and we should maximize it. But it might be that on some other planet, they have evolved something else then, which isn't phenomenal consciousness, which is a completely different thing then, which also has moral value. And there's no way of us knowing it before we have actually met and talked with these people. So in the same sense that I'm worried that utilitarianism might be too narrow, simply because we don't know what kind of other non-physical stuff is out there. Again, I'm kind of this. I have a non-physical view then of this consciousness, but just like that, I'm also of course worried that pleasantness and unpleasantness might not capture everything that's valuable about consciousness. Then so. Yeah,
but you do think that consciousness captures everything that's valuable.
I do believe that, and I believe that pleasantness and unpleasantness also. But there's a lot of things I believe which I worry that I might be wrong. So yeah.
Yeah, of course, that's something we share. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about this? Let's say we travel to this other planet and we meet them, these other creatures. And they have evolved something that they consider morally valuable, but which is not consciousness.
Right.
It's as though I can understand the words you're saying, but not really. I have trouble even conceiving what this other thing could be.
Right, sure. But I mean, there's a lot of things we have trouble conceiving of, right, which probably exist. So I mean, conceivability and possibility are not very well aligned, probably. So I wouldn't be able to, and perhaps we would never be able to actually understand what they are talking about. But I mean, if they seem like honest, decent people on this planet, we might be convinced that it still has moral value. I mean, these are people, they have thought a lot about it, and they have realized that this kind of Schwalia or whatever it is, it has moral value. And then, you know, we might just decide that, well, we might not give it full consideration, but we'll definitely be a bit careful about not being letting them be too unpleasant-schling or whatever it is they are talking about.
Yeah, when I talked to Anders Sandberg, he mentioned this notion of consciousness plus, which is the similar notion to what we're talking about here.
All right.
And the... the idea is again that these creatures with consciousness plus would insist that this consciousness plus is just it's important, and maybe it's even more important than our consciousness.
Right.
But you can ever only know that consciousness plus is important if you experience consciousness plus, and we cannot just in virtue of the kinds of creatures that we are. Is this worrying?
So I think that this is another case where its philosophy is really important, because it's really easy as a non-philosopher then. I'm not talking about Anders Sandberg, who knows basically a lot of everything, but I mean, yeah, in general, yes. it's just very easy to think of this as a problem. When you haven't encountered that much epistemology, for example. But when we do encounter epistemology, we see that knowledge in general is just very problematic. So it's just hard to account for a lot of knowledge. And perhaps what the only thing we have is some degree of some credence then in our beliefs, or some amount of reason to believe in certain things rather than others. So, I mean, I'm not sure if I know that you are conscious. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I do have very good reason to think so. And I think that the same, when we consider like our lack of knowledge, in a lot of areas, then I think it becomes a lot less worrying when we encounter these kind of aliens. So we wouldn't be able to know whether they have this consciousness plus. But I mean, is that really a problem? I mean, we'll get to know them sooner or later, and then we'll talk with them, and then we'll realize whether they are trustworthy or not. And I mean, if they are trustworthy, nice people, we'll just do like we do with any other trustworthy, nice people. We just trust that they know what they're talking about. And especially if they have like a long cultural tradition with consciousness plus, then they have like philosophized in this for a long time. So I think we would just like, all right, great, there's this consciousness plus, let's take that in consideration, at least in our mutual dealings and so on. I mean, that might be problematic if we think that we should be able to like quantify and calculate exactly what action we should perform, but I think that's unrealistic in any case. We basically just have guesswork to do. We have just our best guesses, and we will do some best guesses in that case as well.
Yeah, yeah. There's an interesting parallel here between knowledge and rightness, both of which have been conceived as kind of having strict criteria in traditional philosophy. And what I would do with knowledge is to transform knowledge talk into talk of credences. Which in a sense weakens the criteria, as I would do with strict talk of rightness, where we instead, in my opinion, should talk of degrees of goodness. This is less strict, but it retains its usefulness, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult question. I mean, so I think one thing I would ask you here is what you mean with should here. Is it the moral should or?
Yeah, here I have an exotic view. I believe that the epistemic should is grounded in the moral should. So we in a very ultimate sense, we should believe that which maximizes the balance of pleasure over pain. But it just so happens that in this world, it is very often the case that believing, having true beliefs, leads to better outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to take you up on the exotic view discussion here, but I definitely, I mean, yeah, so. I think that I don't disagree really with your position here. I mean, so there is still, I recently read like Alistair Norcross' book on scalar consequentialism.
Yeah.
And when doing that, I also read Martin Peterson's book on multidimensional consequentialism, which was a really good book. I can really recommend reading it. So
It's technical. The one that incorporates notions of risk and so on into the calculation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's completely wrong, but I mean, it was a really nice book, I think. So it's lifted up a bit technical parts of it, but I still, at least for me as a non-technical philosopher, it was completely readable. I mean, so there's this weird thing when people talk about scalar consequentialism. So first, I say something which I think is sensible, which is that there are these kind of degrees of rightness and wrongness, and that even if there aren't, we can talk about it and people will understand what we mean. And it's important to focus on this. And I think all of that sounds really sensible. But then they say that we should instead talk about this, or we should change our concepts and so on. And I mean, I don't see why we need to go there. I mean, I think we have these concepts of rightness and wrongness, and we have a scalar concept here, and we have a binary concept there, and that's just like how it is in the rest of the world, right? So we have a lot of these cases. So you can talk about someone being tall or short, but you can also talk about the degree of length then. So, and I mean, there's no reason to do away with one expression rather than the other. I mean, they have their uses, and I mean, one use for rightness and wrongness is when we do retrospective evaluation. So when we look back then, and then we say that, well, did we do what was right here? Or is there like, could we have chosen a better action when we try then to plan for the future? And I think it makes sense to use the binary expressions here. No, we acted wrongly. I mean, we didn't act that wrongly. So then we're moving to the scalar concept. But we still acted wrongly, which is using the binary concept. I don't see why we need to legislate of just using one or a few of these terms. So if I'm posing the question to you, can't we use all of these? Can't we just keep all of these concepts in our language then?
We definitely can. From my perspective, it's just a question of what is most useful for us. And I think that talking in terms of credences and degrees of goodness, I wouldn't talk in terms of degrees of rightness, but I would talk in terms of degrees of goodness. That's the most useful talk for the purposes of maximizing utility.
Yeah. All right. I mean, that's a fair view. I mean, I would probably say that I don't know whether that's the most useful, but I do have a fairly high level of credence in that might be the most useful. So,
yeah, let's talk about action guidance, which is
right.
the first half of your dissertation.
Finally, something just which I feel like I'm a bit of an expert on it. It's, I may have managed to muddle through the philosophy of mind and definitions.
No, it's great.
Various stuff here. I'm ready. I'm ready for discussing action guidance.
Okay. Just in general terms, what is the problem of action guidance?
Yeah, good question. I hope someone could tell me. No, but I mean, a lot of people have this view that it's important in some sense for moral theorists to be action guiding. And if you look at the literature here, I think, is pretty bad in a pretty bad shape, which is surprising given that there are a lot of intelligent, reasonable, and nice people working on it. And so it's really really difficult, actually. So I think I've read most of the relevant literature on action guidance, and it's really difficult to see why. But it's both difficult to see what action guidance is. It's difficult to see what the problem is here. I mean, it's very difficult. But here is the basic idea. Many people seem to think that a moral theory should be action guiding. And when they say should be action guidance, which is a maddening terminology often used, they might mean different things. So it might mean that a moral theory isn't true. I mean, it's false if it isn't action guiding. They might mean that we have reason to believe it's false if it isn't action guiding. They might mean that it's not interesting or important if it's not action guiding. they might mean that it's bad if it's not action guiding. And with bad, they might mean a lot of different things then, of course. So that's the kind of... But at least there is this strong intuition. A theory should be action guiding. And it seems very close to how a theory... to the idea of being helpful. I mean, being... So one thing I did in the dissertation was to take this idea of helpfulness very seriously and try to compare with how we think of maps, for example, and signposts. And so I think that that's the most promising route to understanding what action guidance is then, and perhaps also why it's important.
If we take this notion of maps and signs and so on, if we then have another moral theory based on rules, say that our moral theory is the Ten Commandments, and we are told that we may not kill; it is always impermissible to kill. That is paradigmatically action guidance guiding, and the problem. With action guidance and consequentialism is then that we can almost it seems very difficult to know what we should do because it's because we don't have these hard and fast rules.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
That's at least I think that's fair. I mean I think that's at least the kind of the basic way of outlining this, then I think it becomes a little more complicated because, so for example, we would have to make sure that, I mean, it's not all, I mean, a lot of these non-utilitarian, non-consequential theory will run into some problems with action guidance as well. So, for example, you would probably have to restrict it to intentional killings and so on. I mean, causally, I'm bringing about the deaths of a lot of people just by sitting here, for example. And
because you fail to donate to charities that save
exactly,
their lives.
And so on. But also directly, I think, so I mean, even if you think that I'm not causing their deaths, which is, I think, at least a somewhat plausible view, I'm still causing a lot of other people's deaths then, for example, and this comes into this chaotic effects of actions then. So, I mean, the one worry here is that minor variations in how we act, these variations may then ripple outward and change a lot of things then. So, I mean, the easiest way to see this is like procreation. So, I mean, just when a couple decides to have sex, the day on which they decide to have sex, or even the hour, will most likely decide the identity of the children, which will then have many other acts. And so, and at some point, as these changes like ripple outward, then they will surely at some point lead to the death of people. I mean, if not in 100 years, then in 1,000 or 1,000,000 years. So it's at least somewhat plausible to say that you have then killed these people.
For example, I take 5 seconds, or let's say I take, I'm trying to find my credit card in the supermarket, and I hold up some person that's standing in line behind me. This person then arrives home later, and this changes the time of procreation, which leads to a person being born, and then let's say 5 generations later, a person murders another person, and this would not have happened had I not stalled people in line at the supermarket.
So that wouldn't be a case of you murdering this person, of course, because murder, I think, is conceptually closely tied to intentions then, but it might very well have led to you killing this person then. I think for killing, at least this causal connection is sufficient. perhaps, I mean, I'm not a philosopher killing in any way, but anyway, I mean, the basic idea is just that when we think of these chaotic effects, then we see that non-utilitarian, non-consequentialist theory might also have problems with action guidance. Of course, we also see that utilitarianists and consequentialists have huge problems with action guidance because the consequences here will, of course, also be different for millions of years from these kind of, what you mentioned, the credit card holding up, taking up the credit card, holding up someone in the queue. And yeah.
Just so to object here, just to object, why is it that I think this will sound counterintuitive. Why wouldn't the effects just wash out?
Right.
Of me, I stall some people in line behind me, and the effects of this action, they wash out over the course of a couple of days. Why isn't it plausible to think that these effects will just disappear? They will have no influence on the long-term future.
So I think that to see why they wouldn't wash out, it suffices to see that at some point, an act of procreation then will be changed. And because our identities are so incredibly sensitive then to how procreation takes place, then, I mean, there are millions of sperm-ovum combinations which are possible. I mean, and even if not all of these are viable, a bunch of them will be. And I think it's obvious that once you have one change in identity, there is no washing out taking place. So you have to attack and say that before any, I mean, it will wash out pretty quickly before it can affect any acts of procreation, even very minorly, like with a minute or so. And how would that occur? One idea which I had, which I discussed in the dissertation, is this, that there might be timing correctors, which I call them. So, and this is probably not the concept which I should have any credit for. I mean, it's a very common sense idea and probably mentioned by a lot of people or thought about by a lot of people. But a lot of us have kind of certain, a lot of entities which are agents then will always try to correct for minor variations. So for example, even if I go to bed 1 minute later this evening, I will still go up on the same time because that's when my son needs to go to preschool. Similarly, a meeting will start at the same time, regardless of whether people are a bit hurried or more or less hurried when going from the train. They will just speed up to make up for lost time. So, I mean, that would be one reason why they could wash out. I mean, but the problem is that, well, I don't think that there's enough of these timing correctors to do the job. And it's another complicating thing here is that if we were satisfying utilitarians, I mean, we just need to reach a threshold level of goodness, and it's a bit lower or even far lower than the maximal one, that might give us, be comforting in this situation. It might mean that we need not worry too much. But if we're maximizing utilitarianism, then even if there's just the slightest longer sensation of anxiety, then that means that an act can be transformed from being right to wrong then in different scenarios. So I think that even if you look at timing correctors, it's first very unlikely that they will actually be enough then to stop us from, in many the situation in a day, then stop us from having effects rippling out and shaking procreative acts. And even if they could, then it just requires, I mean, you just have to have a small change then, or a small effect on pleasantness then, or pain or unpleasantness of sensations, to actually make a difference for rightness and wrongness.
Yeah. What about if Earth is destroyed by an asteroid in 100 years, so that the effects do not ripple out for that long? You mentioned millions of years.
Sure.
Could it be that these giant space events just prevent actions from having extremely long-term effects?
Right. Yeah, that seems, I mean, that would be like a giant timing corrector. It would just, whatever we do now, which is a boom, and then we will kind of reset the whole clock. I mean, that's possible. But still, I mean, even if I, suppose that I call someone 1 minute later, and because I call someone 1 minute later, I say a few different words to that person. And because I say these different words, that person feels a little more anxiety then. I mean, even that then is enough will be highly relevant then on the utilitarian theory. And again, we are maximizing that.
Yeah, you might say that you inspire this person to work for a space agency, and the space agency sends some space probe from Earth before it's destroyed, and then there might be ripple effects from the space probe and so on.
And not just probe. I mean, we are sending out radio waves. We are already. It's easy to think that we're not causally affecting the universe, but we are, right? So it's, but even so, even if we just look, even if all effects would wash out in 10 minutes, say, it's still wildly unpredictable what kind of effects we will have within these 10 minutes, simply because within these 10 minutes, there will be chaotic effects, and they will very quickly ripple them from person to person. It would be, perhaps if we are like completely isolating ourselves, so we cannot get out of a room, for example, and we are preventing all kind of information from coming out. And then we also have like this washout thing. Perhaps then we could be sure that an act is right. I mean,
that and might of course be possible. We're never in that situation. Or
no, we're not.
So is it just completely hopeless for utilitarians?
Well, I don't think it's hopeless, because I think that we can still make best guesses, right? So we can just, and so that was one thing I advanced then in the dissertation. Then that, well, there is this concept of action guidance then, which focuses on coming to know that an act is right, which is a bit like when you read a map and then it's just crystal clear, you need to go here. And then you, on the basis of reading it, you come to know that you should go to this, that this is the place where, for example, Gus lives then. But we can also have another, there's also another sense in which a more theory then can be action guiding, or another way in which it can be action guiding. And that's just giving us, I mean, making it possible for us to, giving us some reason to believe that an act is right. And for example, if I read a map, it's almost completely unreadable, but I still, you know, I still learn something about the location of, for example, your house or someone else's house. I mean, I think in that sense, utilitarianism can be action guidance. We can still learn something. And so we have some, come to have some reason to believe that an act is right according to theory. A lot of my dissertation is basically then trying to say that this is enough, which I'm not sure if I succeed with, but I think that for me at least that's enough. I mean, I'm satisfied with these kind of best guesses. So,
could you explain the analogy you introduce with barrels of oat and barley, because that kind of drove home the point for me.
Oh, that was great to hear. I mean, apparently a lot of other people haven't thought that I draw home the point with it. So it's good that I was vindicated in including this barrel example. I'll explain. So the idea is that, well, suppose that you're in this warehouse and you have a boss then, and would then have instructed you then to take care of these barrels. And then, so what you do is that you open one of the barrels, and there's like 1,000 barrels in there. And you open one of the barrels, and on the top of it, you see that it has slightly more barley then. And so now the manager, you don't know anything about what is usually the mix of oats and barley. It might be just in this barrel. It might be in all barrels. It might be that, but you have no clue. Anyway, the manager comes in and he tells you, well, you have to make a choice now. I have to send the barrel with the most oats minus barley to this customer. I have to send it now. Can you just give me a best guess? Or in this case, I should say there's actually two barrels. So you have opened two barrels, and you see that one barrel has more oats minus barley than the other barrel. So the idea here is that it's just rational for you then to guess. Since you don't have any time to open any other barrels, it's just rational for you to guess that one of the two barrels here with the most oats minus barley has, in fact, the most oats minus barley of all the barrels. And since that's rational, you must have a reason to believe it. That's the fact. So you have a reason to believe that it's the fact that it has, this barrel has the most oats minus barley. And so I think that this is just analogous then to the moral case here. So the barrels are just the alternatives of actions, and each barrel then, when you see the top, you see some consequences, but far from all of the consequences. And again, I think that in the ordinary moral case then, you will have some reason to think that an act is right, even if you have only considered two acts, and even if you only have considered some consequences of each of these two acts. So that's the idea.
So we have some minimal reason for choosing the one barrel or the one act,
yes,
in which we have some, however slight information as to the goodness and badness of the pain and pleasure of that is instantiated by choosing this act or choosing this barrel.
Because if we wouldn't have that, it wouldn't be rational. It would be rational to flip a coin in this situation. And I think that's obvious not the case. If the manager comes in, says, you can't open any more barrels, just give me the one with the most oats minus barley, then you don't flip a coin. You pick the one where the top, where the very thin top layer has the most oats minus barley. And you give that to the manager. And
this is because you would be ignoring information if you chose to flip a coin. So you would be acting irrationally by ignoring the slight information that you have.
Right, and rationality here must be connected to reasons. So why the explanation why it is rational to pick this barrel is that you have some reason to believe that it has this property of having the most oats minus barley of all the barrels then. So note that the manager doesn't ask you which of these two barrels that you've opened have the most oats minus barley, or which have the most oats minus barley on the top thin layer. The manager is asking, of all these 1,000 barrels, still, even in that situation, I think it's reasonable to say that that you have some reason to believe that this barrel here in front of you has the most oats minus barley of all the barrels. So. Yeah.
And of course, you might be completely mistaken here.
So
you're not claiming that it is likely that you're correct. You're just claiming that you have some information that when you act, you must incorporate this information in your act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's extremely minimal. It's not even, I mean, it's extremely minimal claim here.
Yeah, and I think you're right.
It's very different from the situation still when you have no information at all. So you have this very famous article by James Lenman then, who discusses these chaotic effects then, and he talks about cluelessness then and say that according to utilitarianism, then we will be clueless. But then all the time in this article, he says that we're nearly almost clueless. And I think that's a huge difference. It's a huge difference between a map which you cannot even read or interpret in any way, I mean, which doesn't give you any information, and a map which gives you a little piece of information. And so I think that when you think that action guidance matters a lot, if you want to use that view, that idea, to challenge utilitarianism, you have to show that it's not enough with this minimal information. It's not enough with this minimal type of action guidance. I call it evidential action guidance, but you could basically call it whatever you want. I mean, they have to show that utilitarianism, that what matters is some kind of much stronger type of action guidance then. So, for example, that you can come to know then that an act is right then.
Before we move on to that discussion, I would just touch upon this, the boss in this analogy, the boss or the manager here, the person who tells you that you need to give me a barrel right now, is analogous to the laws of nature or to time pressure or what is
like
the analogy there?
Yeah, that the choice situation will pass, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is we in a sense we always face this boss in real life. Yeah.
I do think that some people might think this is a discomforting view of morality. I actually have the opposite view. So imagine that you stand in the warehouse then, and it turns out that this barrel didn't have the most oats minus barley. I mean, I think I wouldn't feel too bad about it, really. I mean, you know, I just had opened two of these barrels, and the boss comes in and says, well, you were wrong. Man, it's barrel 585, which has the most oats minus barley. And I think that would just feel pretty fine. I mean, I just had a chance to open two of them. And I just had a little, I mean, I was just looking at the top of them. I mean, I didn't have time to do anything else. So I think that we should not feel too bad about acting wrongly. And I think that's actually a very comforting thing with utilitarianism then. It's, to me, the theory feels at least much more psychologically compelling when we think about how weakly action guiding it is. Because, you know, I think I have the most reasons to go out and help a lot of animals now. That's my best guess what utilitarianism demands for me. But I mean, you know, the evidence is so weak. So, I mean, if I can play a bit computer games or something, I'm not going to feel too bad about it. I mean, it's just, you know, there was so weak evidence anyway. So to me, it's like pretty psychologically comforting. It's not worrying in that sense at all. I mean, it's pretty nice. I would be far more stressed out if I actually had knowledge that this was, I mean, that would be horrible, I think. That would be a horrible life to live. Now I just feel, well, I'm pretty sure I didn't do what I should have done, but, you know, I basically have almost no clue anyway.
The classical move here would be to say that we should feel bad or feel good just in the way that allows us to maximize utility, such that self-hatred because you fail to maximize utility is probably not the thing that's going to maximize utility in the future.
Right. But it also very weak evidence, I should add there. I very weak evidence that that's true or false. So, but yeah, sure. I mean,
do you see this as a potential problem if this we have such weak evidence that we are, in a sense, we allow ourselves not to do our best?
Well, again, it's important to not. So here is one thing you might say, which I think is confused. So you might think, say something like this, well, this is, we have very good reason to think that this is the action here that is right, and to give all this money. And therefore, it's very important that you don't feel like you do, Simon, because if you feel like this, then you will fail to undertake this action. But my view is that we don't even know this first thing. So, I mean, it's not just that we have very good reason to think that helping these animals or these poor people will be best from the utilitarian point of view. But that from my individual perspective right now, I just have very small clue. I think that we don't even have a very strong reason to think the first thing in the first place. I think that it's, you know, I might help some animals, but then you have all these chaotic effects. Who knows? So I think that this is, sure, I mean, it might have bad consequences that I think in this way. Then again, it might not. It's like these barrels, you know. It's just very, very hard to have any kind of strong evidence. So, on this topic, I don't think that there is any problem at all here. I think that it's psychologically comforting, and it's people talk a lot about fear utilitarians being demanding, but I think that it's pretty undemanding in a psychological sense. Actually, I think that it's very relaxing theory because you have so little evidence, and so you can always. It's very easy to excuse your behavior then.
But don't you have the little evidence you have? I mean, this evidence just suggests to you that you should work for an effective animal charity as opposed to playing video games or playing computer games.
It does.
So can we conclude from that that you should work for the animal charity?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on... I mean, I might have that... I do have that belief that... But that belief is very weakly supported. So it really doesn't bother me that I have that belief that much.
But it is better supported than
absolutely. So I would be I am acting irrationally when I'm playing these video games. But then again, I'm just not very psychologically worried about acting irrationally when this kind of judgment about irrationality then, which I have, is so weakly supported. So this is just a psychological point. It's not I definitely think that we should, of course, in a moral sense, do these things, because sometimes we may decline to form a belief, of course, about issues, but then again we might also form a belief just on basis of this very weak evidence. But it's just a psychological point. And I think that matters because a lot of people seem to think that utilitarianism is a very psychological demanding, not just demanding in this moral sense then, which is a problem, I guess. I would admit that's a problem. But also psychological demanding. You would just live a miserable life if you become a utilitarian. And I'm not living a miserable life at all. I'm often not caring that much about what utilitarianism tells me to do, simply because I have so little clue about what it is. I do a lot of other things, of course, like helping spiders out. I'm very kind to all kinds of animals who come into my house and so on. But I'm not doing it because it's right. I'm not doing it because utilitarianism tells me to do it. It's mostly just instinct when informed sometimes it's just instinct, but sometimes it's also just because I know that it might still be, like you said about scalar consequentialism, I might still have very weak reason to believe that this is better than, for example, it's better than helping this fly. I had a mosquito living in my room for 5 months or something last year. It bit me every damn night. But I couldn't kill this damn mosquito because I just felt so bad about this mosquito. Did I think that it was right to not kill the mosquito? No, but I did think that it was at least more right to not kill it than to kill it.
What about your annoyance? Don't you think that your annoyance from being bitten by the mosquito would outweigh the value of the mosquito's life?
I don't think so, because, you know, I was just annoyed a little time before going to bed, and then after going to bed, having this damn mosquito bite on me. But, that mosquito, that lived the whole day, you know. And, it was a good life. That mosquito had a nice meal of blood every evening. It got a bit old in the end, sure, but it's still, I have a very weak reason to think that was more right than not. It was definitely not the most right. The most right would have been to go up, sit to my computer, and then apply for some kind of animal rights organization, or just donate all my money immediately to them. But it was still more right than to just kill it and go to bed again.
Why do you believe, just briefly, why do you believe that animal, effective animal charities are the best use of money?
Yeah.
And time.
Right. I might be wrong there, but it's just the best guess I have so far. From what I have read, people who are doing this like full time surely have much better, more informed views here. But if you look at, for example, animal charity evaluators, I think they're doing a superb job. And there's just so much pain going on in factory farming. And also, it's even worse, I think, when you have the kind of hedonistic view, which I like, because you also, except for the pain, you also have a lot of anxiety. So I was raised on a farm. And I remember you could see these pigs. They didn't seem to be in physical pain, but they were like chewing on the iron bars, and you could see that they were not in a good mood. They were not feeling well, even if they didn't have any physical pain. So I just think that stopping factory farming is a lot of factory farming, at least, is a good way to go. either that or just raising a huge amount of small sentient beings. But it's very difficult to just donate money. There's no one doing that. I might do it when I'm retired, but there's no way you can just send money and they will raise, well, they will tell you, well, we have just raised 1 million goldfish with sentience. I mean, that won't happen. So I will just, with good lives then, of course.
You could pay someone to spread forests where more wild animals will live.
Yeah, if you have wild animals suffering, and that's a tricky issue, I think.
Yeah, so you believe that say the average mouse does not have a life that's worth living.
Yeah, that might be true at least. I don't know, and it's yeah. I know some. I've talked to some people who are much more into this, and it just seems so tricky. So I mean, I don't know. It's super hard, I think, to determine what kind of lives they live in the wild. I mean, also because a lot of offspring die young. There's also a lot of this anxiety and hunger and so on. So hunger, we often consider like, well, this mouse is now hurt. Then we have to consider its pain, but we seldom consider all the other feelings and sensations that animals might have. And I think anxiety, fear, hunger, these are very powerful sensations and can be very unpleasant. So
the sort of minimal action guidance that you claim exists for utilitarianism, is that enough? That's the in a sense the obvious next question. Is that enough for us to act on?
So could you say something about what's enough to act on means here? Sorry for being a philosopher, but
well, what I'm thinking is that this does not live up to the traditional notion of action guidance, where we just have knowledge about what we should do. So is it enough?
It doesn't. I don't think it does. I think that our ordinary concept of action guidance isn't this kind of evidential weak guidance. It's this stronger type of guidance.
Yeah.
But right. Even so, it's not enough. Just because that's true, you still have to explain why this ordinary, stronger type of action guidance, why that is important or matters or whatever you want when you do that. Not having that is very bad for moral theory when you do have this very weak type of what I call action guidance. Then you might not call it action guidance, call it something else than minimal guidance or something if you want to. But I mean, you still have to explain why, when you at least have this minimal guidance, why a theory also needs to give this kind of stronger guidance. And I think this is, so I tried to wrestle a lot with this within thesis. And I mean, as with any dissertation, well, you're a young philosopher trying to finish finish your PhD. I mean, it's a very difficult discussion to have. I do think it would be good to have a lot of more people working on these issues, because what I found in literature was that it was very difficult to see what type of objections here were made or why that would require this strong type of action guidance.
The answer is that no one has successfully established that we need this strong form of action guidance, but you have established that we have this minimal action guidance, and yeah, so we should, before we ask why we should have reasons for asking for more for the strong kind of action guidance.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so. That's the kind of, I think that's the question I would ask those who think that it's very important with action guidance. So, and also I would ask that question, but I will also ask another question, namely, what are the implications for a theory? And that's something which is very just badly, I mean, it's just very badly structured in some of the discussions here. Again, a lot of good people have written a lot of I mean, I think nice texts here, but I still think that there's a lack of structure to discussion. And one question here is, so suppose that it is needed then in some sense. What does that mean? Does it mean that the theory is false if it doesn't have this kind of, if it isn't action guiding in this sense? Or is it, does it mean something? So a lot of people talk about the point of moral theories. So what does that even mean? I mean, suppose that it is the point of moral theories then to be strongly action guiding in this sense. I mean, is that something, could they still be true as moral theory? Does it have any implication for its truth? Does it have any implications for how interesting and important it is? If it does not, then who cares that it's the point of moral theories to be in this way? So, yeah.
Would it be suspicious if our moral theory was strongly action guiding?
Yeah. I think it would be a bit suspicious. I mean, but this depends on kind of meta-ethical issues. And so I tried to simply, I didn't feel comfortable with going into that discussion when I wrote the dissertation then. I know people who are really good at these issues. I mean, so one idea is that it's that you have a meta-ethical view, which is something like the following. Morality is made or it's dependent on human beings. And that should then magic, explain why action guidance is this important. I tend to be, my own meta-ethical view is basically this kind of very, this moral realism. I mean, that the moral laws then are very similar to the laws of nature, but also very different. And rightness and goodness and so on are not simply reducible to empirical facts. That's the view I have. And I also have the view that we use intuition then to navigate then these moral issues. And if you have that kind of view, it would be very suspicious then, I think, that if it was action guiding morality, because that would suggest that it might be prejudices and cultural influences and so on, rather than which determined which moral theory we thought was correct, rather than actually being able to glean, have a glimpse of moral reality then.
Under moral realism, let's say consequentialist moral realism, it would be suspicious then.
Yeah, I think so. That would be weird. I mean, I would be very suspicious that we have haven't really listened to our intuitions here. So I also, it's a bit similar to how, I mean, so some people think that's queerness, the Mackie's, so there's this idea that it would be really weird or queer than using this old term. It's really worked nowadays that well, but it would be really weird if there were moral facts. And so my own view is that that's a really comfortable thing. I mean, if we discover something then out in reality, which is really weird, that's a nice sign that we haven't just been fantasizing about it using our old cultural references and so on. It's a quantum mechanics. I think it's pretty, I don't understand it, but the weirdness of it is mildly comforting to me. It seems to suggest that they are actually connecting to physical reality in an interesting way. And same thing with moral reality. I think that to find it weird and to find that if these facts are weird, that's a comforting thing. It suggests that we are not just acting within our little bubble. And same thing with if it's not action guidance, if a theory isn't action guiding, that's also it's. Seems to suggest that we're on the right route. We haven't just that we're on the right way. Then we haven't just worked or taken our cultural and social prejudices and worked them into a moral theory.
I agree that it would be suspicious if our best moral theory was action guiding or undemanding, and that it would suggest that we had just transformed our biases, let's say, into an ethical theory. This point about weirdness in the universe, I mean, we have mountains of evidence that quantum mechanics is true, but how could we have evidence for the existence of these non-physical moral truths?
Right. So the difficult thing here, as soon as we go into this moral intuitions and intuitions in general, is of course that whenever you do this kind of epistemological stuff, I would of course say that it just seems very clear then, in light of what we know, then that our intuitions here is a kind of guide and philosophical issues. But it's kind of, that kind of assumes the thing I want to want to prove then. So it's a tricky issue to discuss here. Here's what I think. I think that we have an kind of intuitive capacity. It's not really good necessarily. It's really sensitive to biases and so on. But still, it kind of helps up approximate at least some philosophical truths then. And I also think that among these kind of intuitions, we have moral intuitions. And they help us see what's morally right and wrong and what's good and bad and so on. So and that's that. And I think that's a kind of evidence. I mean, it's observational evidence in the same sense that we get from our eyes and ears and so on. So intuitions then is very similar to observation, simply. So that's my view. It's, I think you asked me about humor style intuition before doing this podcast, and I really like this kind of humor style view here. So
you might explain what humor style intuitionism is.
I think it's basically what I just said. I mean, this kind of very this optimistic take on intuitions as evidence, and I mean, it's to say that intuitions are evidence in general, then that doesn't mean that you don't recognize all kinds of biases and problems with intuitions. But it means that there's a kind of, just like if I see something outside of the window, or if I have a kind of, if I have a, yeah, if, for example, if a wolf or something goes by my window, I'm actually very near the forest here, so it's not completely impossible. It's quite impossible, but not completely. I still think that observation gives me some reason then to believe that there is a wolf walking past. Of course, then again, I might bring all my background knowledge and so on. I might realize it might probably be a dog. And I might, can I really recognize a wolf and so on? And I mean, so there's all kinds of questions to ask about that observation. But still, it's just kind of this prima facie or pro tanto reason then to believe that there is a wolf there. And same thing with intuitions. I think that whenever you try to doubt intuitions, the evidential value of intuitions, I think it's very easy to use arguments which would also discredit ordinary observations. So I think that this is the kind of there's a very strong similarity then between intuitions and observations of various kinds.
I would like to distinguish between sense data and intuitions. I would say that the intuition is a kind of seeming that something is true, whereas the sense data is just data in and of itself that we then try to explain by our theorizing. I have problems with this intuition talk. I agree that humor style intuitionism is a strong attempt, but I think it ultimately fails. We don't have any reason to believe that our moral intuition track the moral truth. I think that's my basic problem with it. I think we can see that our intuitions are just horribly biased in ways that are they cannot be redeemed from it.
Right.
So I think we should fall back on the phenomenal experience of pain, of pain and pleasure, which I do not take to be an intuition in the same way as, for example, having an intuition that something outside of your conscious experience is wrong. Such that, say, we see that. So if I were a Christian in the 16th century, I might see a homosexual couple and then have an intuition that their relationship is wrong. I see no reason to think that this intuition would give me even a pro tanto reason for believing that homosexuality is wrong.
And I mean I think you're kind of, that's a popular position, right? What you have here is it's a real divide here in philosophy, I think. So could I just try to make a few distinctions and see if we can get a bit closer to each other here?
Definitely.
So one type of intuitions, which I think we should just ignore completely here, is this kind of when you use intuitions as hedging statements and so on. So, you can use like seems and appears to just to hedge statements. And so let's do away with that first. So that's the obvious candidate for getting rid of that. That's obvious, not the interesting question. Then we use seems and appears and so on in another context, and that's when reporting on kind of our evidential situation. So I might say this, well, so summing up all these kind of evidence for and against doing this act, it seems like I should do A. That's not actually referring to a mental state and an intuition then, but just simply summing up my evidence. It seems like I should do A. Just means here something like A has more reason to support A than B. So can we agree that these two should at least be moved away from the camp here, which are interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah. Then I think that there is another distinction, and this is more contentious, I think. So I've tried to talk with this with other people at the department, and they have, I have met with mixed success so far, but I think there is another distinction here, even in the remaining group of intuitions. So consider then intuitions, what we have now, it's intuitions when we take of these as kind of intentional mental states then. So it's kind of intentional states. It seems that something is the case, that there is a wolf moving past the window, that homosexuality is wrong, for example. I think that there are actually two different types of intuitions here, or what we may call intuitions. So one is an intuition which is much more intellectual in character, which is something like making a judgment and based on experience or something like that. I don't know how to characterize this in the best way, but for example, it's more intellectual here. And then there is another thing which is more like raw feelings here of wrongness and rightness. So we often say things like, this feels wrong, this feels right. I think that that's a kind of intuition, but it's not this kind of intuition where it's not this kind of intellectual higher level intuitions, but a much more basic level. And I think that those are the intuitions. And I think that's intuition. I mean, pain just seems when I think that pain seems morally relevant and pleasure seems morally relevant, it isn't this kind of intellectual thing. It isn't as if I've read a lot of books on pleasures and pains. Then, it seems like they are morally relevant. It's not like looking at this huge evidential base and then making a determination, forming this kind of intentional state. It's rather just this raw feeling of, well, it feels morally relevant. It feels important. And so I think that those are the intuitions that we in the end should work with then. And similar, if you have this kind of visual then impression. So first, I might just have this raw impression of a wolf going by. Of course, I have the sense data coming in. I mean, unstructured sense data. I mean, if there is such a thing. I know that you're better on the cognitive philosophy of mind stuff than me here. But just you have this kind of raw impression of a wolf. Then you might also have another intuition, a more intellectual one, which is when you have considered this, when you have looked closely and then compared it with other wolves, you remember how they look and so on. It seems to you, you have this attitude that it seems to you that it is a wolf. And it is the first one here, the raw one, which I think is the basic, is the kind of basic epistemological input here. So I think that would be my view here. And then I don't think it seems so crazy. I mean, it's not like a lot of these biased intuitions are about this intellectual stuff. It's not, but these raw intuitions, I think that's kind of should be the starting point. I do think, however, of course, that some people have that intuition, those intuitions about homosexuality and so on. So, I mean, we might not get, yeah. So what do you think about this?
Well, it is from the raw fields, let's call it that. Yeah. It is, that is where I draw my moral conclusions from in the end. But I would resist calling them intuitions.
All right.
I would, this might not be completely semantic, because I would say they are more analogous to seeing red or feeling cold,
yeah,
than they are analogous to feeling that the
all right
some complex act is wrong. I recognize that in a sense my critique of intuitions presuppose the truth of my style of utilitarianism. But if I could just sketch out what troubles me here, it is that I see no way in which we could have reliable intuitions about complex situations. Because this would require us to have intuitions about how much pain and how much pleasure is instantiated in a situation such as, say, whether we should build a bridge. In the same way that we do not have reliable intuitions about whether a bridge will hold a certain amount of weight,
yeah,
we do not have reliable intuitions about whether the bridge will be good or bad, all things considered. And so I think intuitions about complex situations, these intellectual intuitions, they provide us with nothing of use. They are unreliable.
I think actually I agree there. So I think I'm just going to agree there. I mean, I also think that I do think that, yeah, I think I'm going to agree. That sounds plausible to me. And as you say, the bridge case is an excellent example of where our intuitions may fail there. That was an interesting point. And I think I agree with that to some extent, at least. But then on the question of whether they should be called intuition, that might, of course, not be, as you probably would agree, not very interesting itself. What do we call them? I mean, I might agree to not call them intuition. But do you agree that they are intentional states, at least? So these kind of feelings are not, it's just not having a feeling of well-being, but it's also as a feeling that something is the case.
No, actually,
okay.
I would say it's a very it is extremely basic in a sense. Non-intentional in that it is just what I base the meta-ethics on is this basic feeling of the badness of pain, and right. that is not about anything except for the pain itself.
It's not a feeling that the pain is bad. It's just...
It's not a feeling that the pain is bad. It's just a bad feeling.
Right. Okay.
We might be getting into the weeds here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think we are a different side of the fence, but it's a damn small fence at the moment, so I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that... I was once upon a time, before I did my PhD, when I just did the undergraduate and master studies, I was interested in this kind of foundationalist, coherentist discussion in epistemology. So from what I know now, it's probably not very relevant anymore, but it was a lot of written earlier than in earlier years about that. This idea that, I mean, observations, observations then seem to have this kind of structured character as well. I mean, after the whole the pure sense data, you have this kind of structured, an observation also seems to be structured in a way that, so for example, when I just see something moving past my window, then it just looks like a wolf, like, you know, those immediate impressions. That's kind of where I take my views on intuitions from, that those are, if there's this similar thing with intuition, moral intuitions, then it just seems like it would be wrong to do this or right to do this. And that's, I think that's the kind of, so that's where I come from. And I don't know where the most plausible type of intuitionism here starts. I guess I would say that it's very difficult to do without any kind of input here, at least. I mean, you have to recognize some kind of input just to do philosophy. And when you accept that, it's just very difficult to not also have this kind of similar kind of input in the moral case. Then what that input is, I like to think it's these kind of raw intuitions, but if it might be that there is some kind of layer beneath that, which is the true input, then.
Would you agree that when we reason about thought experiments, our intuitions are more akin to the intuitions we have about the bridge case, because it's a complex situation?
Yeah, I just want to say first that while with some bridges we have pretty bad physical intuitions, we also have good physical intuitions in a lot of other cases. I mean, some very simple bridges we can see directly that they won't hold any weight, and we also have a lot of other trustworthy physical intuitions. So just to get that out of the way, I do think that in some thought experiments, it's definitely, our intuition are definitely not reliable. So, and two things I raise in my dissertations is, one thing is that we might simply be unable to fail to represent the experiment correctly. Then, so we may be asked to imagine that an act maximizes pleasure minus pain, but then we may fail to represent that correctly. So I still think that if we really represent it correctly, then our intuition would be reliable. But I think that we often fail to represent it correctly because we are using a kind of our model of the actual world often, or what is natural to assume in a case then. So that was a messy answer. Sorry.
No. Could you briefly tell us about the experience machine, the utility monster, and transplant, just to sketch out what these thought experiments are?
Yeah. So, I mean, these are, of course, very general thought experiments used in a lot of cases. I mean, experience machine is usually put in terms of an evaluative thought experiment. So when looking at hedonism, that's a theory of the good life and so on. So in the dissertation then and in some other cases as well, you use a moral version of this case. So if doing so would maximize pleasure minus pain, would it be right to plug in another person or plug in a population of persons to an experience machine? And some people would say that it's not right. But utilitarians would say that it is right, and then you would have a conflict. Transplant is basically about sacrificing the life of one person, then taking that person's organ and transplanting to five persons, so the five persons can live then. So many people think that this is impermissible, but utilitarians would say that it is permissible, and then we have this conflict again. And the utility monster is just, if we consider a person or entity which would, from getting your materials and resources, experience much more pleasure minus pain than you would from these same resources, then it would seem to imply that we all should give our resource to this utility monster. And that seems wrong. It seems kind of, you have kind of equality intuition here kicking in. But utilitarianists would say that we should give all our resources to the utility monster. And so we have this clash again here. So that's basically the three cases.
In the transplant case, you write about your own, let's say, imaginary imagery of the case, in which you imagine a kind of the basement of a hospital in which this illegal operation is carried out in secret and so on. And you write about how this might influence our judgment about the rightness or wrongness of the case.
Precisely.
It's irrelevant.
Yeah. So my idea, so I coined the term misimagining here, in this part of the dissertation, just describe the phenomena when we, which I think is just very, it's just a very common phenomena where we try to imagine something and fail doing it. And I think that transplant, as it is usually put, is a perfect case of this. So I think that the proposition that we fail to imagine is that operating on this one person will actually maximize pleasure minus pain. And that's because we look at this case and then we find it, we simply find it very unnatural then to think that you can get away with this, that the transplants will take. That's, by the way, a real problem, which, I mean, it's not very realistic, these transplant cases, because it's not that easy to just transplant organs willy-nilly. And that no one will find out, that it won't have like legal and cultural repercussions and so on. And of course that these kind of, that the person, that the operation itself will be a success then. So I think that we tend to misimagine it, Kate. We tend to import all these other irrelevant is the wrong word. We tend to import these other considerations into the case because they are natural to imagine in the case as described. And for that reason, we actually failed to imagine the case. We failed to imagine one of the propositions of holding. So we actually imagine a case where we do not maximize pleasure minus pain by killing the patient. So that's kind of my speculative attack on these kind of thought experiments then.
Could we become better at imagining cases?
Yeah, so that's one of the... I'm happy you asked the question. That's one of the things I argue for, because we can use our imagination then to make it natural to imagine that it maximizes pleasure minus pain. So, and I think that there's so much focus on thought experiments having to be realistic. I think that it might in many cases be the other way around, that they should be made less realistic, because when we have a realistic case and then we just import this single proposition, this little thing in the case, which is very unnatural to it, a very unrealistic aspect of the case, then it's very easy to misimagine that. And transport is precisely such a...
The single thing we say is then that this act maximizes utility.
Yeah, right? Exactly. That's a very unnatural assumption to make in the case. And the problem with realistic cases is that you often have a huge realistic case, then a coherent realistic case, where you then add a very unnatural assumption to make in this case. And that then may fire this misimagining. And that might be a reason to make the cases less realistic, to actually construct a situation where it would be very natural to imagine that an act would maximize pleasure minus pain. And I think the fiction then in various ways is the precisely right way to go. So one thing I kind of toy with, I'm not sure if it's the best way to do it, but you can imagine a science fiction case where you have a doctor in a kind of wasteland hospital, you know, civilizations has collapsed, and then you have basically you have six persons walking into this hospital, and you can choose to. And this doctor then has a very good knowledge of transplantations. The hospital is completely autonomous. They can perform any transplants and make them work. They can do gene therapy and so on to avoid tissue reaction. And it's a very advanced hospital. The people coming in are the last people coming there. And it's also very easy to escort them out. So this will be a one-shot opportunity. And then the doctor, then when they're all sedated, discovers that she can either let five of the person die because of their inner injuries, or to take the organs from one person and transplant to the five and let these five persons walk out then and be escorted to safe lands. So in this case, we have kind of removed a lot of the realistic aspect, which might interfere with the case. So we have removed all legal issues. We have removed the chances for failure. We have removed the possibility that other people would come in later, and then that there would be the kind of corruption going on and so on. So, and I think that when I consider this case, this science fiction case, I just feel it hesitantly, but I do feel that it would be right to kill this person and help the five person. I do think it would be horrible, but some things are both horrible and right, I think. So that's the kind of one suggestion I have, that you kind of use unrealistic cases instead of realistic cases then to get more reliable intuitions, or rather to get the right case to have intuitions about them.
We should make our thought experiments more like science fiction in order to have more accurate intuitions about them.
Yeah, or rather, we should make sure that the crucial assumptions in a thought experiment, the crucial stipulations, are coherent or natural to imagine, given the rest of the thought experiment. So, and that might sometimes involve realistic cases, sometimes not. But that's the important thing. You should just make it easy to really imagine that doing this will maximize pleasure minus pain, and not subconsciously or non-consciously importing a lot of other stuff about the legal ramifications and will someone find out the seller and so on. I mean, and so that's what I think. It's a pretty modest suggestion, but I think it would improve the outlook for utilitarians in a lot of these cases.
Do you think reading fiction in general helps us think about thought experiments?
I don't know. I don't think so. I'm not. I think a lot of fiction seems to have. A lot of fiction is driven by the author considerations. So the author is trying to create an interesting narrative and so on. And you have all these fictions, for example, when it simply cannot, I mean, however implausible it seems, like the hero can always save everyone, all the six people will be able to survive and so on. But anyway, I think that you could definitely construct fictions, which would be helpful here. So you could construct fictions and write fictions about utilitarianism, for example, which would be helpful in evaluating these kind of thought experiments.
In which we cut off the facts of the case, which makes it seem unrealistic that a certain act actually maximizes utility.
Precisely. And in experience machine, by the way, you can do something similar. So you can say, instead of just imagine that you get this machine in post order and you just, you know, put it in the room and then plug in, and then you're putting this kind of cables in your head, you imagine a kind of civilization which for 1,000 years has run these machines flawlessly, and then you just add a lot of these things to the case. And I think that when we do that, it seems a lot more plausible that we should plug in people to this machine.
Or you could do the reversal test, in which you say that actually your whole life you've been living in an experience machine, and yeah. Should you choose to enter the real world, you will have your experiences will be those of a 75-year-old Siberian farmer, and they will be worse than your life experiences are now. I think that reversal shows us that we have maybe a status quo bias, yeah. And not a bias against, or not a legitimate concern about living fake lives or simulated lives or so on.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and I love this kind of this reversal test. I think is fantastic. So absolutely.
What about the popularity of utilitarianism as a theory? How do you think the situation looks now in academic philosophy?
Yeah, it's always hard to say what people think. People don't tell you what they think. So I always hear that there are a lot of utilitarians in Sweden and where I live. I seldom meet anyone. I meet Torbjörn Tännsjö, of course, but there a lot of people don't tell other people what they think, even in philosophy. But I mean, I think that at least utilitarian style thinking is doing well, given the effective altruist movement and so on. When we look at academic philosophy, what we have is a profileration of different positions then, which has just advanced in later years. So first, we had a big rule utilitarian discussions in the early middle and forward 20th century. And then we had this preferentialism versus hedonism discussion. And what happened was that, I mean, you just have these explosions of different ways in which you could modify the classic utilitarian theory, which I would subscribe to then. So the popularity, I would say that it's some kind of consequentialism is popular, but whether classical utilitarian is popular, I would say no, it's not very popular. Would be my guess then. But again, it's difficult to know what people actually think.
I think one problem might be that in undergraduate philosophy studies.
Sorry, Gus, you disappeared there. Could you say again?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Now I hear you well again.
Okay, good. I think one problem is that in undergraduate philosophy class, these thought experiments are introduced, such as Nozick experience machine, and then that's basically it. Not that it's taken to be conclusive, but it's taken to be almost conclusive, let's say. So such that the experience machine refutes hedonism. I think that's unhelpful if you compare to the situation in the literature in which there is more disagreement, of course.
And another problem, I definitely agree. And another problem, I think, is that when you have this kind of introductionary book, so it's often the case that utilitarianism is the only clearly, or one of the few clearly defined theories. And then you have a lot of like very vaguely described theories, which cannot even be counterexampled in a clear way. I think that a good exception to this is actually, so Mark Timmons wrote this excellent book about, I think it's just called More Theory. I think I looked at my library shelf here, where he actually determines to just spell out very clearly all the different theories he is going to test. And so that's a good approach, but I think often that's not how you do it. And then, of course, utilitarianism will be in a bad shape simply because it's so clearly described that it's very easy to use counterexamples against it.
It is, in a sense, a punching bag for moral considerations. I think it's interesting to consider that utilitarianism has survived for let's say 100 years of criticism. And I think you're completely right that that utilitarianism is often some, you know, in a sense, this might contradict what we have been talking about in this conversation, but you can just stipulate that some act maximizes and maximizes utility, and then go on to criticize it.
Yeah, and I kind of I guess that was one thing I tried to do in the dissertation, and to try to just argue that things are not that easy. Even when you do stipulations, you still have some work to do, because you have to make sure that, well, you have to look at that you make sure that we actually imagine the case correctly then, and imagine it the way in which our intuitions are reliable. I think that another thing which seems attractive with hedonistic utilitarianism is that if you look at like Bentham and Mill, and also Singer, of course, but he is of course still alive, but even Bentham, I mean, he got so many things right. And in this extremely hostile environment, I mean, hostile to utilitarianism, he just followed this principle and got so many things right, which we today take for granted, like his views on animals, his views on sexuality, and so on. I mean, a lot of that is just, it's just awesome that he could arrive to those conclusions completely, I mean, in that kind of cultural environment. And so I think that, I'm not sure how exactly that supports utilitarianism, but it seems that in some way it should, because,
I can see what you mean. I agree that it's simply impressive that Bentham predicted our current moral views in a sense. But of course the counter argument or the counterpoint is to say that, well, Bentham was wrong and everyone is wrong now, and this doesn't prove anything.
Right.
Attitudes have moved in the wrong direction. And where people would believe that they have moved in the right direction.
I agree. I mean, that's of course possible. And I feel that there is an argument there. I would like to find it, but I haven't yet. But there's something very appealing still with how he just could. I mean, so I think that homosexuality was actually had a death penalty in England at that time. And how you could just come to the conclusion that it's just entirely morally unproblematic. I mean, that's just still it's very impressive, I think.
Yeah, and it does require let's say independence of mind.
Yeah, definitely.
But I mean, you could postulate that when we create moral theories, let's say we're trying to predict the attitudes that we will have in the future. That might be a beginning to say that Bentham's views support the truth of utilitarianism. But again, yeah, I don't know if it holds.
I mean, one view which I like is simply that we have this kind of nice direct connection to moral reality, and then that connection can be disturbed then by our cultural influence and so on. So when we have someone like Bentham, who has this capacity to just ignore the country cultural environment, that person will just see very clearly the moral landscape or the moral truths out there, and so at least when we ignore the chaotic effects and so on, we allow ourselves to stipulate that, for example, that this homosexual act will not like lead to an asteroid collision or something. I mean, it allows us to make a kind of moral progress. So that's also why we then have these kind of more and more our moral beliefs then tend to improve then. And Bentham was simply one of the first then to be able to see past this kind of cultural fog then. So yeah,
we could hope that, or I would say that Singer engaged in the same project of trying to quite simply work out the implications of utilitarianism. Yeah. And we might hope that the effects of altruism movement is also at least inspired by the same project.
I hope so too.
The concerns about existential risk and factory farming and the welfare of the poorest people in the world arises from utilitarian considerations. At least that's a big part of it. So let's see if in 100 years they were vindicated by the attitudes of future philosophers or future AIs or whatever might exist by that point.
Yeah, I feel that there's hope for the future with the effective altruism and this kind of utilitarian influenced movement. I think it's fantastic, and as a utilitarian philosopher, I feel this is a great thing going on right now.
It is, in a sense, the modern equivalent of utilitarianism, heavily inspired, I would say, and I guess they would agree, the members of the EA community.
Yeah.
Could I get you to tell me your credence distribution over moral theories? How likely is it that your favorite form of utilitarianism is true?
Yeah, let me think for a while. So one problem you have here is the kind of how fine-grained you should become, right? So, I mean, every level of fine-grainedness will lower the credence here. But let's not complicate things. Let's just take the kind of view which I outlined here in the dissertation. I would say I probably have something like, I don't know, 30-40% credence in 30-40%, and then I also, in every alternative theory, I have less, of course, then. Otherwise, yeah, I wouldn't believe it to be true. So, something like that.
Seems reasonable to me. Should we begin by taking the results of the Phil Papers survey, which is a survey of I think 8,000 philosophers, maybe less, some thousands of philosophers? Should we begin by taking their assessment? They're asked whether they lean towards or accept consequentialism or deontology or virtue ethics. Should we begin by this and so to speak, update on peer disagreement?
I think that sounds like a very nice way of doing it. So I love this kind of, you try to basically find a base rate or some starting point then, and then you update on that. So yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, I would say that my credence is probably different from my belief here. I mean, I very strongly believe that utilitarianism is true, but I
feel the same way, definitely.
That's a different thing, of course, from having a very high credence in it being true. I also think that it's completely good. I think that people, it's not bad to be to have a very high, strong belief in something. That makes motivate you to explore it. Just keep that a bit apart from your when you actually try to give your credence.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I would like to, even though we traditionally speak of credences as modeling beliefs, I would like to separate my credences from my belief in a sense. In my heart, I feel that utilitarianism is true, but when I consider it from the outside, rationally, I can see that it is less likely than I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that in general, it's very easy to have very high credence. So it's often a good thing to push them down a bit. And I think that a few years ago, I would probably have given a much higher credence in it being true then. But I think that I have kept my conviction in the sense that strength of belief, but I definitely think that there's a lot of, just that there are so many difficult issues here to be solved means that one should be a bit skeptical here. So
Yeah. It does seem weird to conclude something like Bentham was right. And that is, in a sense, what I would be doing if I were to say that I have a very high credence in utilitarianism being true. It seems weird to say that some person discovered the true moral theory, in the same sense that we would say that Newton discovered a true theory about physics.
Yeah, I'm not that hesitant to say that. I mean, because I think that the laws of nature and the moral laws are very similar then, in a way. Obviously, that comes from a different mathematical picture. But I do think that it's, try to not be too overconfident then in our assessment of moral theories. And I think one problem is that there's just so much. I mean, we have known so little about the alternatives to utilitarianism. And I think that so people focus so much on evaluating utilitarianism and often then dismissing it. But there's so few really well thought out, you know, very well precisely characterized alternatives. I mean, you have libertarianism as a moral theory. I mean, those kinds of view can be pretty good. But I mean, I think that we have just scratched the surface on like the moral theory space at this point.
Yeah, I can agree there. Okay, well, Simon, it's been fantastic to talk to you.
It's been a great fun talking about utilitarianism this long time. So thanks for having me, and good luck with your future podcast. So,
well, thank you.